Hi, everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and I represent the political center. Have on the political right, John Dougal.
Hey, good to be with you. Welcome back.
Yeah, thanks, John. I heard Ben did a nice job. And on the political left, Shireen Gourvani.
Hello, and hey, listeners. I hope you're doing well.
John and Shireen, I was in a meeting.
It's a beautiful spring.
It's lovely.
It's a beautiful
it's lovely.
Week.
Yeah. I was in a meeting earlier today, and a gentleman came late. He said, sorry, I was late. I was watching the news. And we're like, oh, what news? And he said, have you not seen the markets? And we're like, oh, what's going on in the markets? And he said the U.S. just, you know, made some provocative moves towards taking over Nova Scotia. And we were all just looking at each other.
Nova Scotia.
And of course, he was
not Greenland.
He was joking.
Oh, okay.
But it almost seemed real.
Could be real.
Yeah.
Just quick. I mean, the world we're living in right now, what are the right words to describe it? There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of chaos. There's a lot of false news. There's a lot of uncertainty. Shireen, what words would you put out there?
Pain.
Pain. Okay.
Yeah.
And we can cover a lot of those on the program today because we've got
two words: unnecessary distraction.
Yeah. Ham-fisted policies. Just in their implementation.
Yeah.
If I'm being generous.
I mean, I appreciate this because it does feel to me that we are living in unprecedented times, truly. And the chaos that this administration is wreaking across our markets, across our institutions, across people's lives is remarkable. And I just think it's really important that we stop and reflect on how not normal this is and how deeply out of step with what I think we should all expect from our government leaders.
John, you're about ready to finish a law degree. And there's a lot of Okay, there's a lot of discussion about rule of law and things, but take us through your thinking a little bit right now on what pressure's on the Supreme Court. And the reason I say that is I don't follow the court very actively, but I do know enough that come June, late June, some decisions start to roll out. And they're sitting on some big things. And they've got everything from, you know, what do you do with this Maryland father that's in an El Salvador prison to some of these people that are getting letters to be deported that are refugees that are here legally.
Students who are legally here as well.
Yeah, yeah, on our campuses. You've got a president that is likely going to be in contempt of court very soon as this works through the legal system. To give us a little bit of a legal take on this.
Well, so as I look at it, not being a lawyer, but just, you know, having fun with this, I look and go, okay, first of all, many will say this is the most conservative Supreme Court we've had since perhaps the 1930s.
Mm-hmm. And it's about time, you know, from many perspectives.
90 years, yeah, about time the pendulum swings back. But Trump appointed several of the folks on this court.
Mm-hmm.
And so if he continues to discredit the court, that will, you know, creates kind of an interesting dynamic when it's largely a court that he formed or framed, and now he's discrediting it. And it's not just what are the rulings coming, you know, May, June timeframe. It's over the next several years. And how will important cases that the president cares about in 2 and 3 years be decided based on what actions he's taking today? Because there is a certain, you know, the court really can't enforce anything.
Yeah.
It only enforces action through others taking action, whether it's the president. And we've seen that, you know, think back to Brown versus Board of Education, took President Eisenhower enforcing basically that court opinion at the time.
I mean,
it didn't just, those Southern states just did not say, oh, yes, we agree.
Yeah, the leaders have to like respond to it.
Yeah.
Shireen, your commentary.
I would just say that there are some really important changes happening, and I think that we should all be paying close attention when we're talking about things like, do we have a right to due process in this country? Does birthright citizenship exist in this country? What are the confines that they're willing to?
It's a big one they're arguing.
It's a big one that they're arguing.
Yeah.
This is a court, yes, that is made by Donald Trump that has a record of rolling back rights. I have fewer rights today in this country than I did before the Supreme Court. And I think it's important that we realize that we could be headed on a path very quickly where we have even more restrictions to the freedoms that we've enjoyed.
Yeah. So a name that we're all hearing, I hope I can get it right, is Kilmer Abrego Garcia.
Yeah.
He's going to become a common name in our country because of the way he has not had due process in stripping him away from his family and putting him in an El Salvadoran prison.
Prison.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then we have senators. Is it senators or congressmen? Is both.
Both.
Representatives.
I think it's representatives in Congress.
Arizona, yeah. Oregon, Florida, California, even our own Representative Kennedy.
Various Republicans and Democrats have gone down there.
Can you imagine?
To tour the prison or to try and speak with those incarcerated.
Yeah. Can you imagine being the head of that prison or the president of El Salvador and the spotlight that's on you when a country as big and powerful of ours is in radical disagreement about what's going on?
What's going on? Yeah. I mean, I think what's concerning is when the president of El Salvador was at our White House, there was absolutely no acknowledgement that what is happening against the laws of this country and without due process, mm-hmm. right? And in fact, what Donald Trump said is that he intends next to send homegrown, so U.S. citizens, to a foreign prison. Mm-hmm. I think that we should take him at his word.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. Well, so...
And that's one of the challenges with Donald Trump. You never quite know when you should take him at his word and when he's just, you know, spouting off.
Mm-hmm.
But if President Biden said that, if Barack Obama said that, we could expect martial law on the streets. I'm just not even kidding. I think that we are so off the rails here. We have to acknowledge how completely unhinged this moment is.
So elaborate a little bit more on that.
Because
right now,
that's a big statement.
What I just heard from that is so many people just roll their eyes and go, oh, that's Donald being Donald, and just ignore it. So we don't have martial law on the streets because, you know, we're not rioting because
he's
like,
a sower of chaos.
It just sows chaos and whatever, and people just goes off their backs because it's like, yeah, it's just one more outrageous statement. Rather than, no, he's serious about this and we're
outraged and protesting.
I would just say
basically everything that he has said, in one way or another, he tries to do.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump, if we genuinely, and I know it's cliche to say it, but I just really would like our listeners to reflect and imagine if Biden had said something like this, if Barack Obama had said something like this, what do you think we would be hearing from our Utah representatives in Congress? What do you think we would be hearing from Mike Lee? We are hearing next to nothing about this. And I think the failure to stand up to what is a very, very concerning march towards autocracy is bad.
Shereen, this is where, I mean, I think it's dramatic what you're saying, but I get the point. Where I really understand it is where we're taking such gigantic risks internationally.
Oh, yeah.
And where we're breaking up families.
Yeah.
And where we're self-inflicting a recession on the backs of our people.
Yeah.
I was thinking of a way to talk about recession. And, you know, normally we have about 50,000 unemployed Utahns. During a recession, it gets over 100,000. So, you know, just think about that's, you know, 50,000 plus more families that have a hardship in this state. That's tough.
Mm-hmm. And
you know, this is real stuff. Like you suddenly have more depression. You have, financial, debt that you go into that's difficult.
Yes.
Divorces occur.
Yes. And many of the recent people who have lost their jobs in this state are losing them because of chaos induced by this administration.
Okay. So we're flooding the zone.
And here's flooding the zone. But here's the question. If hypothetically, mm-hmm. the actions that Trump is pushing in a decade result in a stronger U.S. economy and more manufacturing, more mm-hmm. production here in the U.S., mm-hmm. people will say he was brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it will not happen overnight, and it will be hard to see. And it's a risky gamble that may blow up and make us worse off.
And when legislation was actually pushed through, bipartisan legislation was actually pushed through to address some of these issues, reshoring American industry into American soil, right? When we think about the CHIPS Act, when we think about the Inflation Reduction Act, the efforts that were done under the Biden administration, I do think that this was a failure of Democrats to not tell the story very clearly of a actual policy approach as opposed to a chaos approach to do just what you're saying. So I think it will be very difficult to look back on this time of Donald Trump and divorce it from actual policy that was passed under the Biden administration, should there be any positive outcomes. Mm.
And I'm no fan of the CHIPS Act or the quote unquote Inflation Reduction Act. I think those were abominations.
But I also wanted to say, you're also not a fan of the chaos.
Not a fan. Not a fan of the chaos either.
Yeah. John saw my facial reaction when he said that the president could be seen as a genius for restructuring the global order and reshoring so much manufacturing.
That doesn't happen, but yes.
Yeah, I think that's super unlikely. I think that the economy is not this dial that you just turn and you get something here and you get something there. I think there's trillions of decisions that go into this that have countervailing forces, and I think we're in for some rough sledding if we don't fix this pretty quickly.
Can I ask you to just respond to one thing? Yeah. I am curious what you think about Trump's threats to kick out the Federal Reserve Chair.
Yeah, I get it. Alarm bells are ringing. It's because they've already moved a lot of the Democrats off of the Federal Trade Commission, the FDIC, the National Credit Union Association, SEC. I mean, they've been moving Democrats off. And the president actually tweeted, "Termination can't come fast enough," on J-PAL. So he's putting that out there. Now he's kind of backing off. We're used to that. Here's the thing, though. The Fed is so brilliantly designed. And we have Mariner Eccles in part to thank for that, a Utahn who helped restructure the modern Fed after the Great Depression. And the key is that it's so decentralized, Shireen.
Yeah.
So I've got some notes here that help me think about that. There's the FOMC, the Federal Open Market Committee, has 12 voting members. They're from all around the country.
Yeah.
You have 7 alternatives to those that rotate. You have 19 members of the Federal Reserve Banks. They're all geographically dispersed with long terms that are overlapping terms. So you can put pressure on the chair, but this is an entity that is fiercely independent. And then the final point is that markets would never react well to politicizing the Fed.
Yeah.
So I think it's a hollow threat.
Oh,
but
I hope
let's see
right.
if I'm wrong. Let's
okay.
see if I'm wrong.
I hope we don't have to.
Yeah. What else do you guys want to talk about? Because one of the things that I noticed that I thought was interesting was this whole idea of the Harvard pressures going on.
I think we might have to touch on that in
Should
our next segment.
Should we do it segment. In our next segment? Okay, yeah. Stay tuned, everybody.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shireen Gourvani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the political center, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. We're going to start with Harvard. Take us back to Cambridge and this battle that's going on between Harvard and the federal government. Two things have happened.
It's all about the golden rule. Whoever holds the gold makes the rules,
there
right?
There you go, yeah. Harvard is now suing the Trump administration for freezing federal funds, over $2 billion in federal grants. I know a little bit about that because I know what federal grants pay for at the University of Utah. We also have people threatening to pull the tax-exempt status of Harvard.
So talk to us first. $2 billion, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, a lot of money.
So what kind of grants? What does it fund?
Well, the way I would think of it, isn't it funny how so many things in life go back to World War II?
Mm, yeah.
They really do. Eventually, we're going to say so many things go back to the pandemic. But
or 9/11
the way
or whatever.
Public universities are funded, research universities, is we built an amazing research engine to prevail in World War II. And as that was coming to an end, they had to figure out, what do we do now that we've created this? And they decided to keep it going and lead the world in innovation and research and created the envy of the world in these research universities that have done so much to map the human genome, to help with cancer, to help with everything from autism to you name it. And now that's being called into question. And I think it's hugely problematic. I think research is a public good. If it was a private good, you wouldn't be shared. It'd be marketed. It'd be a profit thing. It's a social good. So who better to fund it than the federal government? And the proof is in the pudding at what we've done for life expectancy, what we've done to improve life quality. Yeah. And I'm thinking of health, but we could also think of science. I mean, just I'm holding an iPhone.
Yeah.
That's coming from research universities.
Yeah. Think about the
goes
internet.
Back to World War II.
It does, though.
Yeah.
Because they built up an apparatus that they decided to keep funding. And so a lot of people are like, why is the federal government involved in research universities? It's like, well, who else is going to pay for research that benefits everybody?
And I do think actually the internet is a really great example of this, because the University of Utah was one of the key first locations in the development of the internet. One of the first four. So when we really think about the impact that the innovation that comes out of these institutions has on our day-to-day lives, understanding the investment to me is a no-brainer. I know that, John, you take a different position on this, and we'd love to hear it.
Do you see research as a public good, John?
Some aspects of it. Some, I think it's just expenditure of money, and too often it's a waste of money that doesn't actually get us there.
Fix the waste.
From
no
my
problem.
Perspective, there's the federal government is too involved, and now we're seeing the ramifications. And this type of thing, I don't care. We've seen small shades of this from Democratic presidents, clearly massive shades here with Trump of, okay, you're doing this. I don't like it. I'm going to withhold these dollars. Mm-hmm. It reminds me going back to when George W. Bush was president and we were bucking against No Child Left Behind. Mm-hmm. And we weren't just threatened with 100 to 150 million of education mm-hmm. funding. We were threatened with $2 to $3 billion of Medicaid, transportation, you name it. They were going to try and withhold it. Mm-hmm. Now, the courts have ruled historically that you can only withhold proportionate of the impact of that activity. Mm-hmm. And so I think DEI and other activities is not proportionate to the $2 billion we're talking about in the Harvard case. Yeah. But it does show a risk that I've always talked about, which is you empower the federal government with this, what you think is a tool that now becomes a weapon used against it. And I think our universities have become way too beholden on the federal government. And now we're seeing ramifications of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you're saying that at a time when we're also seeing states really step back from funding, and we have that happening in our own state.
Yeah.
So the cost of schools continues to go up. I continue to hear complaints from your side of the aisle about, you know, how expensive college is getting. But we also know that the mechanisms by which it's been funded over time, for example, state dollars, have declined.
Mm-hmm. Well, so USU, case in point.
Yep.
And the more easy federal money you get, the more it drives up the cost.
One of two public research universities in the state, and they have had to cut 14 academic programs.
This is something the legislature required them to come in and cut.
Yeah, this is separate from what the feds are doing. And let's think of this as organizational improvement or efficiencies. They're trying to take
realignment and saying,
they're trying to take low return, you know, academic programs.
Not many students in these programs, and they cost a lot of money.
And then reallocate that to something better. I think this is a positive pressure mm-hmm. to kind of work through. You do sometimes scratch your head at what they come up with. In the case of USU, the head scratcher was they had environmental engineering as one of the cuts. I feel quite confident that it's just because they can do that under civil engineering.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but I don't know.
Yeah.
But it'd be good to know. But that's...
Well, and it likely happens at other institutions. I'm sure there's environmental engineering at the U.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, it's civil and environmental combined at the U. Yeah. So
it's not like the program won't exist in Utah. It just may not exist there.
Yeah. Okay. So another one. Anti-union bill. The coalition that is trying to override the legislature's bill on this delivered 320,000 signatures.
Yeah.
It's the law to repeal collective bargaining, public
to
employees.
To reinstate. Yeah.
Yeah,
so,
and this one would reinstate it.
Yeah.
This looks like it's going to happen.
Meaning it's going to get on the ballot, what you're
saying. Yeah, I think these signatures are going to be approved, and it sounds like there were apparently 20 bankers' boxes of signature packets.
Yeah, I collected a number of them myself.
Look at you, Shireen. You're always out there doing this.
Well, here's what I'll say. I think what was so unusual, maybe disappointing, not surprising, were the comments that came from our governor, which said that, you know, he was very impressed with the effort and that he didn't really care for the bill, but he signed it anyway. I think this is where I just get so frustrated with our governor. If you didn't like the bill, especially this bill that was wouldn't have had a veto proof majority. Right. Mm-hmm. So like it would have his veto could have stood, mm-hmm. but he chose to do nothing about it. Mm-hmm. And I think that is really disappointing.
Yeah. You know, Shireen, I don't know a lot about this background. I do know from being in a governor's office that you learn about the entire decision tree. Mm-hmm. And you probably know what I'm referring to there. But it's this idea that there's only an appetite for so many vetoes. And after that, the legislature will convene themselves into a veto override session and throw, you know, these vetoes out. And so a governor has to look at all the bills that he did veto. He took some courageous vetoes and he has to decide how close to the line am I going to get? And he let this one go. Maybe he let it go because he knew this would happen.
Maybe.
I mean, there could be some real strategy behind it. I don't know.
I just think that there's a real question, too, about are you on the side of the legislature or are you on the side of the people? And I think there's lots of opportunity to be on the side of the people.
Well, I would disagree. I would say this bill is on the side of the people. It's not on the side of the unions, but it's on the side of the people. Mm-hmm. It's in the best interest of Utahns.
Okay. That's what the left and right do is disagree. Hey, Mike Lee.
Yeah.
This is stunning. And I would invite our listeners to check our facts here because it's that stunning. But in the first three months of the year.
Or check the tweet.
Utah's senior senator has tweeted more than 9,100 times. That's an average of more than 100 posts every single day.
Yeah,
I think this is based. Mike Lee is the account. I guess since March, it's been every 10 minutes with no sleep.
On average.
Yeah.
I'd like to know.
I'm looking at John like with my mouth open, just like, what?
I'd like to know how his recent town halls have been going. or where he's shown up in our state. I mean, I just see him as incredibly absent when it comes to engaging with the public here. And I have to say that the ecosystem that is X now is incredibly insular, and it is incredibly toxic. Mm. So I think that this is, again, not surprising, disappointing action from our senator.
But here's one of the dynamics. I agree with you about the toxicity. And yet this is where a lot of folks, a lot of constituents show up here. A lot of constituents are looking for the message
here. It's enough reason to stop doing it, John.
Yeah.
Well, I spent a lot of time with two really outstanding scholars, Tim Shriver and Arthur Brooks. They both do a lot in, you know, civility and dignity and public dialogue. But they're very clear on the brain science that these types of behaviors, what social media does, the algorithms, the you know, the brain upticks you get when you get a like or
the
when you get friends,
oh,
whatever it is.
Natalie liked my post.
Yeah, well, they get it. It's addictive. And what I'm seeing here feels addictive to me.
Yeah.
And I would just challenge our senior senator, I feel like I'm friends with Mike Lee, to give it a skip. Try 3 weeks of not putting anything out on X, and I bet you'll be happier.
So let me ask you a question. How do you engage with the public? I mean, I just said a lot of folks show up on Twitter. That's where they're looking to hear from their elected officials.
So
I think it's a horrible forum, but that's where a lot of folks are.
Not many folks.
They're not watching TV news and other. So how do you engage with folks?
Yeah. So I'll just say, I think the number is significantly down since Elon Musk took it over. But when I was in office, it was something like 13% of people in the nation were on Twitter. So we're talking about a significant subset of folks here. The other thing that I think is really concerning is the people that he is interacting with and the world in which he traffics is not your everyday Utahn. It just simply isn't. So it is an ecosystem of far-right extremism, from my perspective, that really is an echo chamber. And this happens on the left too, but that is where he is.
That's my question.
John Curtis, though, I thought this, I have some arguments to lodge against this, but recently wrote a op-ed that I think was in the Trib, basically saying that we need to rethink town halls. And I will give him credit. I don't think he shows up in the hard places, but he does show up in this state. So you see him traveling around, out talking to federal workers, out talking to people, farmers and communities. I haven't seen him, you know, walk into, let's say, a community health center or.
I've been at two of his. This is in earlier, you know, when he was in the House, but two of his in Price.
Yeah. He is out there. John, and Mike Lee simply is not.
I got to tell you, John, though, I agree with you that this is a tricky, like, how do you get your message out? And I'm old enough, I guess, to remember when you used to be able to take out a full page ad in the local newspaper and it meant something. You could take out a full page ad thanking someone for, you know, what they spent on education this year, and it would mean something. And now you might as well just go in your backyard and scream. And that's about the same amount of people will hear you.
If you're the front page story, it doesn't matter. You may be a one day story and then it's, and most people didn't even see it.
But I have to
say,
there's something deeply deluded about what he's doing here too.
If you're in the world of policy leadership, thought leadership, I would encourage him to go to social journalism, and that would be Medium. That would be Substack. Write something in depth, you know, have some nuance. Go ahead, John. He's saying that nobody will read it.
TLDR, too long, didn't read. You know, it's
here's my angry tweet.
This is the world that we're sitting in. It's like, okay, you had more than 140 characters. Yeah. It's too long for me to read.
Maybe I would say that some of our people need to be reading fewer short things.
And I know it's not the audience we're talking to on this show, but this is the weird reality that we're in today.
Hey, two more things I want to cover. I want to talk just for a minute about, this is just, it gets to a local issue, but the Trump administration trying to boost the birth rate, asking for ideas from the Heritage Foundation and other people how to do this. Utah's birth rate has declined or stayed even for 15 consecutive years. It's fallen from 4th to 10th in the nation. 1.8 births per woman, Shireen.
Yeah.
Wow. Quick comment on that, and then I want to give just a second on the death of our Pope.
I'll say that this is truly dystopian, actually. I find it very concerning when a government wants to encourage the birth of multiple children, do all sorts of things to have people have children, and then do very little to support them. This happened in Romania under Ceausescu, and it had devastating outcomes for folks there. Many children left in orphanages. It's not good.
John, some of the countries that have the most pronatal policies, let's think of Norway, Sweden, whatnot, they have some of the lowest birth rates. So I'm a little skeptical that this is going to work.
And, you know, I'm always a skeptic of the government's going to incent some behavior. I just want them to stop punishing behavior. You know, look at what they've done that's driven up the cost of housing.
Could agree with that.
Cost of, you know, impaired job employment, whatever else. Get the government out of that stuff.
Let's go from Salt Lake City to the Vatican. I got about 30, 40 seconds on the program. Quick comments, John, first you, then Shireen, on the death of Pope Francis.
Pope Francis came in, clearly a unique situation with a pope resigning. I think he was loved around the world, clearly cared a lot about people, and a lot of people are sad and suffering right now as a result of, they knew he was sick, but I don't think they expected the day after Easter, I mean, literally hours mm-hmm. after Easter, that he was going to pass away.
Yeah, Shereen.
As an unrelenting advocate for the poor, he will be missed.
Yeah, and the first pope from Latin America. Okay, that's a wrap. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gourbani and John Dougal. Program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thank you so much for listening.